I'd like to get started as close to on time as we can go. Okay. I'd like us to get started. This group is a working and interim work group that combines House and Senate forces. And what we're looking at is the charter schools. The State Auditor's Office recently completed a report on charter schools, and we will be examining that closely and looking at any legislation that we need to shore up the charter movement. We wanted to start, however, with some history, some background on charter schools, because in a lot of cases people have a lot of different opinions but aren't real sure or don't know where this all came from in Minnesota, and from Minnesota then across the nation. So we've gathered the people who were instrumental in the beginnings of the charter schools in Minnesota and then ultimately in our country. And so I would like to have our House research people talk briefly about some introductory things, and the charter school law, initial law, where that came from. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd like our members to introduce themselves also on our committee so that we know who's here. Good.
Well, I'll start. I'm Senator Kathy Saltzman, and I will be co-chairing this work group with Representative Slocum, and we do have a number of other senators who expressed interest in being here and apologize they could not be here tonight, but this is obviously an issue that we think is very important and really welcome the opportunity to work with the House, and I think starting today with the background is really a very good place to start to have some history. Because charter schools were certainly something that started here in Minnesota, and like we're very proud of that fact. So thank you very much for having us here today.
I'm Shelby McCoy. I'm a legislative analyst for the Education Policy and E12 Budget Division.
I'm David Hand, State Senator from Eden Prairie. Serve on the Education Committee in the Senate. I've had a long-standing interest in charter schools. In fact, I was visiting a charter school this morning. And I think there are things, opportunities for us, and I hope we get a chance to talk about some of those.
State Senator Jim Carlson, and I'm from Egan in Burnsville, and I'm on the Senate Education K-12 Policy Committee.
Chuck Wigger, State Senate, Chair of Education Policy.
Lisa Wilson, House Research. Christina Hassett, House Education.
And I didn't introduce myself. I'm Linda Slocum. I represent East Richfield and Eastern Central Bloomington. So we're going to move to our staff people, to our research people, to present an overview of the charter school law.
Representative Slocum, thank you very much. On your agenda today, you'll see a list of a number of individuals who were intimately involved in the promulgation of the original charter school law. One of the individuals not listed here because of family circumstances is Representative Becky Kelso. But I wanted to let you know that at your direction, I did talk with Representative Kelso about her recollections regarding the initial law, because there were, as I think you will see, a number of competing perspectives underlying the law, and Representative Kelso holds one of the perspectives, but certainly not the only one. So some of the remarks I have here reflect the conversation that I had with her. She was the House K-12 Education Finance Chair at the time this law was enacted. What I'd like to do, and then I believe Ms. McQuay will follow up with subsequent changes, is talk a little bit about Minnesota's 1991 charter school legislation. I do believe that there were at least two competing perspectives underlying this law. One was a desire to offer struggling students and their parents another educational alternative, and in addition, to explore on a small scale some new approaches to successfully educating children. Another differing perspective was a desire to develop a perhaps radically new approach to public education. And I believe that there are a number of witnesses here who can talk about that perspective in considerable detail. I think that it might be said that these two alternatives and perhaps alternative and perhaps competing approaches may help explain some of the ongoing debate that we still are experiencing about how best to organize, operate, and oversee charter schools. Very, very briefly, I want to touch on a couple of points. These competing perspectives, the fact that the initial charter schools were not called charter schools at all, but outcome-based schools, that sponsors were deliberately given a very limited role in overseeing charter school or outcome-based schools, that there were limited numbers of terms for operating these schools. There were some clear perceived advantages and disadvantages to them, some problems at the outset in terms of their operation, and finally a couple of policy questions that were evident from the get-go. As I mentioned, the initial legislation was groundbreaking and politically contentious. Some people, including Representative Kelso, saw the law as a way to give families with struggling students an alternative and also to explore some new approaches to educating students, but this exploration was meant to be on a small scale. I think you might even argue that this notion about creating innovative educational alternatives was reflected in that 1991 omnibus bill, because we had provisions on alternative delivery of specialized instructional services, for example. We had a task force on education employment transitions, and we created a legislative commission on children, youth, and their families also in that same bill. Other legislators and stakeholders, and you'll hear from them later, saw charter schools in a much more significant opportunity for change. The initial charter school legislation is framed in terms of outcome-based schools, and you may ask why. Well, in 1991, the then existing State Board of Education had given preliminary approval to replacing the high school graduation rule at the time, which was based on Carnegie units, with an outcome-based education approach. This approach was a combination of several education theories that had been developed since the 1950s. Fundamentally, though, outcome-based education programs were premised on a belief that all students can learn if schools are properly organized and operated. The 1991 legislation allowed only school boards to sponsor outcome-based schools, and this created a conflict. It was how to ensure that schools met basic legal and educational requirements applicable to all public schools, and yet still allow these outcome-based schools to operate in an unfettered manner. The legislators, anticipating that school boards would serve as sponsors and wanting to give these new charter school laboratories sufficient opportunities to succeed, sought to make the sponsor's role minimum. For example, Representative Kelso said this, that she wanted the sponsor to ensure that all interested students had the same chance to attend a school, and that no student would be excluded based on race, socioeconomic status, innate ability, disability, and other attributes. And I think this attitude is in fact reflected in how the advisory committee that existed in 1991 was established. It had 10 members, and of the 10 members, 8 came about as a result of having two members from each of four minority communities, American Indian, Asian Pacific, African American, and Hispanic representatives. And also, that same advisory committee was required to have at least 5 of its 10 members be from families who were eligible for a free or reduced price lunch. The specific authority for that committee pertained to reviewing proposals from predominantly Caucasian individuals and organizations that wanted to serve a majority of non-Caucasian students. So the role was very specific, Representative Kelso recalled, and it had to do with ensuring that all kinds of at-risk or disadvantaged students would have an equal opportunity to participate. The initial legislation allowed a school board to sponsor up to 2 outcome-based schools and allowed the State Board of Education to authorize a total of 8 outcome-based schools. There were all kinds of minimal requirements at best. There was no specific language on whether a school board must vote to sponsor a school. There wasn't any specific language about a sponsor's oversight of a school's financial or educational performance, although the terms of the charter school contract was supposed to stipulate the educational outcomes that were required. There's language about licensed teachers, a requirement that a school board submit an affidavit with the State Board of Education for approval. If the State Board didn't provide approval, there was no appeal. There was no requirement regarding minimum number of board members. There was a requirement that the majority of board members be licensed teachers. There was no expectation at the time that that an outcome-based school might expand its operations to additional sites or add more grades, and there was no requirement that board members receive financial management training. Outcome-based schools were subject to the same kind of audit requirements as the school district, but more specific audit requirements that you see in the law today did not exist. The law stipulated then, as it does now, that outcome-based schools were exempt from all statutes and rules except those specifically made applicable. However, in subsequent years, a number of changes were made to address issues that perhaps hadn't been anticipated or for which the legislators wanted to adopt a wait-and-see posture. For example, we have to say specifically that a charter school is a public school, even though I believe that was always the intent. There was a prohibition against providing education or generating revenue for homeschool students. There was a requirement to comply with student records. There was an admonition that there would be a financial penalty if non-licensed teachers were employed. There was a requirement or a permission to allow teachers to perform the duties of school administrators. There was finally an ability to, on the part of the charter schools to provide transportation for their students. There was a subsequent ability to lease space from a sectarian organization under some circumstances. We ultimately allowed charter school operators and sponsors to seek a change in sponsorship. And we prohibited charter schools from entering into real property leases with related parties. There were advantages and disadvantages to these schools. Some of the advantages included a perceived autonomy in terms of mission, ability to raise working capital, often in the form of grants and administration. These outcome-based schools were seen to fit within the existing education reform framework. They appeared to require little or no funding and appeared to cause little disruption in the education system. School boards, interestingly, tended to sponsor outcome-based schools that serve particular populations, including at-risk students, students with disabilities, and dropouts. Proponents saw outcome-based schools as a means for having more educational choices in the form of better curriculum, smaller classes, and a longer school calendar, offering teachers greater autonomy, and providing local communities with additional opportunities for involvement. Opponents, however, perceived that outcome-based schools represented a lack of community support, insufficient accountability, and a, erosion of local control, which included lost revenue from resident students who enrolled in these schools, the obligation to use scarce district resources to assist these schools, and possible liability that would arise from the operating of these schools. There were a number of problems that arose initially in operating these schools. One of them had to do with transportation. The school district in which the outcome-based school was located was charged with providing transportation to resident students who attended the school located in the district. The effect of this arrangement was that the outcome-based school had to coordinate its schedule with the school calendar of the school district that provided transportation. And therefore, the outcome-based school had little ability to offer an alternative school calendar. These outcome-based schools could not bond facilities and did not have access to other levies for ongoing facility needs. The schools had mixed success in finding inexpensive and suitable facilities under these circumstances. And one more problem that arose pretty much at the outset, it seemed to be that some of the outcome-based schools did not anticipate the extent of the difficulty, complexity, and need for resources associated with complying with state and federal special education laws. Finally, a number of policy questions arose from the outset in 1991. How much regulation or absence of regulation would be appropriate? How comprehensive must contractual terms governing education outcomes and assessments be? Who is responsible for ensuring that outcome-based schools develop appropriate outcomes, that students meet those outcomes? And furthermore, how would these responsibilities be realized? What business-related planning and other support is needed and appropriate to help outcome-based schools begin operating? And finally, would a lack of startup funds or limited funding to facilities affect the further development of outcome-based schools?
Madam Chair and members, I'll just go on to touch on some of the changes that were made over the years since the charter school law was initiated. Beginning in 1997, the cap of 40 charter schools was repealed. In 2002, then 74 charter schools were operating in Minnesota, and currently there are about 144 operating. There are 144 charter schools operating. Just briefly, I looked at other states, and of the 40 states in Puerto Rico that have charter school laws, 26 have caps, although this was based on 2005 data, and there may be some updates to that. In Minnesota, the 13 charter schools that opened by 1994 and 95, three have closed, and a handful have changed sponsors. The eligible chartering authorities have been broadened since the chartering law was established, and currently, local school districts, intermediate school districts, public and private post-secondary institutions, and charitable and service organizations are eligible to sponsor charter schools. The charitable and service organizations are subject to some criteria, such as minimum balance requirements. The Commissioner of Education may also charter schools on appeal. In other states, again, the 40 states and Puerto Rico that have charter school laws, in the majority of those states, the sponsor is the local school board and or the state commissioner. One of the problems in operating outcome-based schools that Lisa had mentioned were the startup costs. This was addressed with federal funding in the amount of $150,000 or a grant of up to $150,000 for a planning year. Subsequent grants for operational years in year one and two are available in the amounts of up to $150,000 per grant. This is federal startup assistance that is given to the Minnesota Department of Education, and schools then apply to Minnesota Department of Education for these funds. The state then administers those grants. This is, I think what the state does is give an estimate of how many charters they're expecting to come in with applications, and the federal government gives awards the grant, and so all charters may not receive the $150,000, but it's up to that amount. In addition, there's state funding for during the first 2 years of the charter school's operation. The charter school is eligible for aid in the amount of the greater of $50,000 per charter school or $500 times the charter school's per pupil unit served for that year. The federal funding, the perk of the federal funding is that there is a planning year grant, whereas the state funding is charter schools are only eligible for the state funding once they start operations. In general, the general education revenue for charter schools is for each adjusted marginal cost pupil unit, the state average general education revenue per pupil unit. I don't want to get in too much to the funding aspect of charter schools because this is a policy working group, but I think I'm just going to touch on three other revenue streams for charter schools because it has to do a little bit with what Lisa had brought up earlier regarding the problems that were there in the beginning. Transportation funding was addressed in that charter schools can either provide their own transportation or use the services of the school districts in which they're located. Because in a few years ago, transportation funding was rolled into the general education revenue, charter schools that don't provide their own transportation receive a reduced amount of per pupil transportation. Of that average. Referendum revenue was charter schools don't have a tax base, and so they cannot generate referendum revenue like a school district can. However, the referendum revenue is an equalized referendum, and so the equalized aid portion of the charter school student's referendum revenue from his or her resident district follows the student to the charter school. So in addition to the general education aid, they also receive the equalized aid portion of the referendum revenue. The owning the building or leasing space was addressed with charter school lease aid. Charter schools can use operating capital revenue to cover the cost of their lease, but if that amount is deemed insufficient, they can apply to the Department of Education for lease aid, and this is the lesser of 90% of the approved cost of the lease, or approximately $1,200 per pupil.
Thank you. That was very informative. We've had some new members join us, and I would like them to introduce themselves. We have already done that. We start on time here. So if we could start over here with Representative Greiling.
Mindy Greiling, and I start meetings on time, too, so I'm glad you did. And I'm an ex officio member, but I actually came to the legislature 1 year after charter school started, so I'm very interested in this. Thank you.
Sandy Rummel, Senate District 53, by Fair Lake, Shoreview, Lionel Lake, that area. I should go by school districts, Biker School District, Montague School District, and Centennial.
Steve Simon, State Representative from Hopkins and St. Louis Park, representing the Hopkins and St. Louis Park School District.
State Senator Rick Wolfine, and I'm not used to getting to the meeting on time, so forgive me. But
And on that note, Madam Chair, I am just very pleased that we've had such a wonderful turnout tonight. So come when you can. That's I'm just very pleased because I know it's a difficult time and it's during rush hour as well. So thank you to everyone who's here.
I'd like to, at this point, call the people that we have asked to come present to us. So if you would come to the table up front. Okay. All right. Let's have the first three first. Because it'll get pretty crowded up there, I'm thinking. And then the second three, how's that? Does that work? Otherwise, I think we're going to have quite a crowd at the table.
Mm-hmm. Listen, Madam Chair, you know, perhaps to look at this as to have our first three people who are testifying really were involved in some of the policy, in writing the policy and sponsoring the policy, and I think that's very important. And then to have some perspective of some of those people who are actually involved in implementing policy in the early years of our charter school law. So
it can work quite nicely. I'd like you to introduce yourselves to the panel and our group. And this is about you are the originators. And that's the perspective that we really would like you to hear about. How this started, where it came from, what you did, what your role was.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ember Ray Scott Young. I'm a former state senator from the New Hope area. Currently, I'm vice president and chief advancement officer of Lutheran Social Service in Minnesota. It is a trip down memory lane, and I simply want to greet my former colleagues, many of whom I served with, and the new ones. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here, and thanks for the opportunity to focus on the history of charter schools. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Fulton.
Thank you.
I'm Ted Coldery, and I go as a senior associate with a little policy group here known as Education Evolving.
John Aiken, Director, Center for School Change at Trump Institute.
Okay. I'd like to give you the floor.
All right.
Because you have worked together on many of these issues, and we want to go back in time here,
right,
and go down memory lane, and where did it come from?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. I will begin then, maybe just to give the story as I know it, and each of these gentlemen and others in the audience here contributed to this. It was really fun to go back and revisit this, I guess, 16, 17 years later. I will just start a little before the beginning to lay the groundwork for you. I think it was about 1985-ish or so that then House Majority Leader Connie Levi worked on legislation for post-secondary enrollment, and that was the beginning of the choice options in Minnesota. Of course, Governor Perpich was firmly behind the post-secondary option choice. When that passed, there was then some conversation about having open enrollment and having open enrollment be, was currently voluntary, but then having it be actually a mandatory kind of thing so that if people did want to go to another public school, that they would have that option. The school district would have the option of closing if they didn't want to or they couldn't for certain reasons. But in any event, that was another option that Governor Perpich proposed, and that bill to start open enrollment passed in 1988. A little story about that bill, as you go back to memory lane. I introduced that bill, and in it there were three sections, and you had open enrollment, and then you had something called statewide testing at that time, and a third piece. And it had been a bill put together by the business partnership, and there was so it was interesting because there was so much concern at the time about statewide testing that nobody noticed that we had put open enrollment in there. And so it kind of moved along in the process, and it was interesting, and all of a sudden open enrollment by amendment passed in Senator Randy Johnson, Randy Peterson's, all those sweets, you know, Randy Peterson's committee, and all of a sudden it kind of snuck through, and the media had no idea that open enrollment had passed through in the committee. Finally got on the Senate floor, at which time it was debated, and had probably its first real debate. It did pass. It was highly contested in conference committee, with the help of Governor Perpich, did pass with the House of Representatives. But that's a bit of a history because it lays the groundwork for what came next. Once open enrollment was passed, then there was a conference that was put together by the Minneapolis Foundation up north, and it's called the Itasca Seminar. And there were a number of business leaders and policy leaders and legislators who were there, and this is now in 1988. Among the participants, I was invited as the author of the open enrollment legislation, and then also invited was someone you all know, Representative Ken Nelson, who was also the author of the open enrollment legislation on the House side. At that particular conference, there was a real interesting discussion of education reform. Remember, we were a few years after Nation at Risk, and there was a lot of concern about all of that. And some of the speakers there were American Federation of Teachers President Al Shanker. So he, and actually from my own perspective, he was the first person who I had ever heard the words charter school from, was the president of the AFT. And he was actually, he was proposing that teachers be empowered to create small schools within schools called charter schools. Cy Fleagle was another speaker, and he energized the group with his work in East Harlem schools, where dramatic improvements had occurred when the schools were made more autonomous. So also in the audience were members of the Citizens League, which had drafted a report about something called charter schools, and that's where this person came, and I think on board along the way with them as well. Along the way, Citizens League had developed a sort of a skeleton of what a charter school proposal would look like. So all of those folks were talking about charter schools, and that night during that conference, a group of us were sitting around a dinner table, and I actually don't remember all who were there, but we were sitting around and we were literally sketching out on a dinner napkin what charter schools would look like. And that was the beginning of charter schools, was literally fleshing it out on a dinner napkin. And we looked at this and we tried to figure out what it would look like, and the basic, you know, would be autonomous and all those key pieces. For me personally, it was very much related to open enrollment, because for me, open enrollment had opened up more choices for children to access. But the question that arose to me from that conference was, what if all the choices were the same? What if they're all vanilla? What good is it to have more choices to access if you have all the same choices? And to me, that was really what created the need for creating new choices and opportunities, public school choices for children in their own neighborhood. And the other question that would arise is that many, many students of color wanted to go to use open enrollment, but they couldn't, because they couldn't afford the transportation to another school district somewhere far away. Now we needed choices in their neighborhood, and that was what the charter school idea was about. So for me, again, it was the opportunity to have different choices for these children to access, and that was very much in line with where we were going with open enrollment as well. So we brainstormed this whole notion of what charter schools would look like. And people here in this room, Ted and Joe and others, were all involved in this as we were trying to create what this would look like. What I can tell you is that the bill was drafted primarily by the Senate counsel, Jesse Rice, who is now deceased. She truly was a trooper on this, creating brand new law, nothing ever seemed like it, with the help of all of these great folks. And it was, I think, a very unusual initiative in that it was a legislative initiative and not a gubernatorial initiative. So it was very different from open enrollment in that regard. It truly was bred at the legislative level. We developed the first bill in 1989 and introduced it. It passed the Democratic Senate in 89 and 90, but the Democratic House was not very open to it. In the fall of 1990, in comes Education Commissioner, former State Senator Tom Nelson. He formed a task force to work through the remaining issues. So we revised the bill for introduction in 1991, this time with Representative Kelso as the author. Formerly Representative Nelson had been the author. The bill again passed the Senate, but was strongly opposed in the House. But now we were in conference committee, and for the first time we were close to getting this passed, and it was 1991. I'll never forget that night in the conference committee as the debate was gearing up on this, and there were, certainly the Senate was lined up, it was a Senate position, And it was very much bipartisan in the Senate, always was, and I think that's just key to this legislation. It was bipartisan. In the House, it was a little bit more of a question. There were two members in the House who were willing to vote for it. One was Representative Kelso, the author, and one was, I think, Representative Leroy Copenhagen, is that right? All right, and he was there on board, but we didn't have a third vote. The third vote looked to be Representative Ken Nelson. Representative Nelson, however, was under deep pressure from the teachers' unions, and he was up for election, and it was a difficult time for him. He was not quite there yet. He wasn't able to move forward with it, and the teachers' unions were very much opposed to the bill. Finally, Representative Nelson in the conference committee responded to that pressure by putting three restrictions in the final bill. One was capping the charter schools at 8. Second was requiring a teacher majority on the board. That has stayed all these years, and I will talk to that in a moment. I just think that is not a very good thing to have when you're looking at boards. And the third is requiring charter approval by both the local district and the State Board of Education. So we went in with a bill, a charter school bill, that would have allowed either the local school board or the State Board of Education to approve it. In other words, that there would be some leverage. There would be an alternative sponsor. It came out in what I thought was the worst possible form, which was that you had to have both of them approve it. The whole point was to have one or the other, so there would be another place to go, and you had to have both. So when that happened that night in the conference committee of 1991, and then Representative Ken Nelson approved and voted for it in that form, I have to tell you that personally it was one of the most disappointing nights in my legislative career. I really left the room and pretty much in tears. I felt that the legislation was going to be futile, that no charter schools would ever come from it. It was just too tight. There was just no way you were going to get double approval. There were only 8. And it just didn't make sense. Well, the decision had to be made at that time whether to go through and forward with it or not. And I can tell you from my perspective it was a tough, tough choice. And folks in the audience and others helped and made that decision and said, we need to take it through. We need to go forward, even though I knew that it was severely weakened in its current form. That, in the end, turned out to be the right decision in that. The bill then went forward in its weakened form, and I thought, well, it's so weak, this is not going to be a problem to pass. Well, was I wrong? In the Senate, of course, it was fine. It was a weaker bill, and it passed. But in the House, there was still huge opposition. The teachers' unions were very much vocal in their opposition at the time. Some of the key arguments against it were that it was the first step to vouchers. I need to tell you that as the author of that bill, as a Democrat, as a pro-union Democrat, and I oppose vouchers, always have, and that to me was very different, very separate, and always has been, and has continued to be separate. But that was one of them. The second was that it would somehow destroy the union, or destroy teachers' unions, or somehow be detrimental to the union. And we, in fact, made it very clear that in that union's issue, that charter school teachers could unionize, that would be just fine. But we simply wanted it to be separate and autonomous from the district contract. All of that, those issues came up. It was fierce. It was rough and tumble. And Representative Becky Kelso led that effort through the House of Representatives. And I'm sorry she's not here today, because it really is because of her that it passed. It was bipartisan in the House. There was a motion to send it back to conference committee to take the charter school part out. And I think it failed by just a vote or two. I can't remember exactly. Again, bipartisan to keep that in, and then it passed into law and was signed by the Republican governor, Arne Carlson. I think when I go around the country and talk about charter schools, I think the number one thing that people are surprised about is that two Democrats actually proposed it. Because around the country, people seem to think that somehow it was not a Democratic initiative. It is. And in fact, it was very much bipartisan. And then just shortly after we passed it, a guy by the name of John Schrader, who was working for them, Senator, U.S. Senator David Durenberger, took hold of the legislation and decided to take it to the national level. And charter schools were essentially born at that point, again, in a bipartisan way. Senator Durenberger took it and ran, said we want to do some work with this, and worked with startup funding. John was terrific in that regard. Democratic Leadership Council, of which I was a member, asked me to come out to Washington and start working with some of the Democrats on that side. This was in 1991-92. Some of the Democrats I got to work with was a guy by the name of Bill Clinton, as well as Senator Joe Lieberman. Senator Joe Lieberman was the person who was the co-author of this legislation in the United States Congress with Senator Dave Durenberger. And so by 1992, it was well on the national scene as far as an option for kids. And then finally, President Bill Clinton, when he was elected, actually campaigned in one of his debates and talked about how he wanted to take charter schools in his administration. So that's really sort of the bipartisan history of this, which I think is just really one of the most important things about charter schools. I want to just talk a little bit about what I think that's the story of them. But why personally I thought they were important and what I thought they achieved, what they are and what they are not. First of all, they were, for me, number one, an opportunity to empower teachers. That's who I heard it from, was Al Shanker. I thought it was an opportunity to empower teachers, to give them the opportunity to create a new and autonomous school and give them the freedom to be better. The freedom to be better, the freedom to try new things, new ideas, new teaching methods, learning methods. So for me, it was about empowering teachers. I had come from St. Olaf College. I had talked with some teacher friends of mine from St. Olaf who told me that they felt like their hands were tied in the traditional system. The second was about empowering parents and the public. I call it to letting citizens take the lead, so that we as public officials would step back, remove the barriers, and capture the ideas and the energy. It was truly a grassroots movement. It didn't come from a governor. It came from parents who were open, because the doors were opened up, and citizens and parents were allowed to take the lead. That's why President Bill Clinton called charter schools a real grassroots revolution in education. But just as important, and of course for students, it was a whole new opportunity for students, opportunity to be, to have a second chance perhaps, an opportunity to address their needs in a specific way. But just as important is what charter schools were not. And again, this is something that's always been interesting on the road when people hear this. Obviously, they were not partisan. I mentioned that. Secondly, they were never, ever intended as an indictment of the public school system. I am a product of the public schools. Becky was too. They were a tool to help educators to do their job better in times of a demanding social agenda and scarce resources. And so it's just really important to know that it was not about something wrong with our public schools. It was about creating another tool, another opportunity for them to excel. The third is that charters are never about competition. And for me, they were not about competition. They were about a stimulus to make all schools more responsive, not only just the charter schools themselves, but the entire district school, because there would be that stimulus. In other words, if something was going on in Montessori school, for example, in a charter school, perhaps the district would respond with their own. Charters were never to be a penalty for low-performing schools. They were an opportunity to create quality and high-performing schools. I'm concerned with some of the since legislation that basically says, well, if you don't perform, you can become a charter school. To me, that was never what it was about. A couple other things about what they are not, or what they were not, as you see in original intent. The original law did not have conversions, did not allow conversions of a public school. That came from California in the subsequent year. There were no startup funds or lease aid when we started. To me, it was not really about, at that time, it was not really about the achievement gap, but it was opportunities for all kids in their neighborhoods. And And then, as I said, it was not about low-performing schools. So that gives a sense of where I, as one legislator, was coming from. Certainly, 201 legislators probably all had different ideas about it, and certainly these gentlemen all had came from different perspectives as well. But we all joined together in the common purpose of providing more opportunities for kids. I'll close with my favorite story, which is when I was in the legislature, I got a letter from a sixth grader from a charter school. We visited, you know, and she came to the Capitol, and she said afterwards, she said, now, she wrote me a letter, she said, dear Senator, I know, I would like your help. I know there's a governor and a lieutenant governor and an attorney general and a state treasurer. And then on down are the legislators. But please, could you tell me, just as soon as possible, is there anything lower than a legislator? So, on that note, I will close, take any questions, and just say how proud I am of the work that this legislature did develop and create and grow charter schools in the state and around the nation and even internationally now, and how proud I am that the law that we passed was recognized by Harvard in 2000 as a winner of the 2000 American Government Innovations Award. And so really, truly a legislative initiative and one that we can be proud of, a bipartisan initiative that has now gone to 40 states around the country and whatever the latest number is, 1.2 million students.
Just a quick question. You started to mention this, and we really kind of want to stay on the history, but you did mention about your disappointment when the law was changed so that teachers were at least 50% of the board. Can you just note that so that we probably don't have to call you back at a future meeting to talk about that? Because I know that's something that has been questioned by the Legislative Auditor's Report.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman. Absolutely, and thanks for reminding me of that. It was one of the compromises at the time to give the teachers comfort. But in the end, in my view, as an attorney, as a corporate counsel, as one who has worked with nonprofit boards in many, many different instances, it just creates a huge conflict of interest to have the majority being teachers on the board. It also limits the number of people who can be on the board. If it's a small charter school, it limits the number who can serve. And that means it limits the expertise you can bring in from the outside, the financial expertise and the other community expertise that you might need. And so I know that since then they have provided some waivers and such for that sort of thing, but I do believe, particularly having a majority, is just simply a conflict of interest that can impair the governance functioning of any, you know, nonprofit or charter school when they are, in fact, you know, working for the nonprofit.
Thank you, Amber. Any other questions? Let's go ahead and go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be brief here. The story's been well told. Let me just try to set a little context and do a little interpretation. Chartering was an innovation. It was an institutional innovation. It was a system-level innovation introduced by the state. And like most all new things, it was imperfect at the start, and as Lisa Larson has indicated, was gradually evolved and improved by the legislature over time. This is the way things work. It's fun to go back and look at the first outboard boaters in Minnesota or the first water skis in Minnesota. And this is the kind of process that's gone on in this charter sector, both with respect to schools and with respect to the charter sector as a whole. I think that to understand why, I think you have to understand a little bit of the context. The Nation at Risk report in 1983 had been a real wake-up call. But nobody quite knew how to respond. And for a few years, there was a lot of milling around and a lot of vague talk about restructuring, which really didn't mean anything. So people were kind of fumbling. Minnesota had gone into interdistrict open enrollment in the late 80s. And exactly as Ember said, I remember an evening, Joe and I had the four superintendents, I think, in North Ramsey County together, and Joe was arguing for choice, and one of them said, why would anybody want to do that? 95% of our curriculum is the same. So there was a beginning to be a felt desire to have a broader range of opportunities to see what kinds of different schools could be created. There was a great deal of frustration on the part of elected officials and governors. I came to see this in later years when I went around the country talking about what Minnesota legislature had done. Most everybody understood that if they weren't satisfied with what they were getting from the system, there was the option to go to private schools, to go to vouchers, but the understanding was that if you didn't want to do that, and most of them didn't, then you had to accept the existing system in its traditional form. And what finally came clear was, no, the state doesn't have to do that. The legislature is God. It can create and recreate the system in any form it wants. And if it isn't happy with what it's getting, the legislature has it fully within its power to get somebody else who will. So Minnesota gradually began doing this. Open enrollment came in 85. The post-secondary option came in 1985, which for the first time carried the principle that some organization other than a local district could offer public education to the state. This was the colleges and universities offering the top 2 years of high school. So it was after the Citizens League Committee in 1988, and the legislative story then developed in a way that Amber recounted it. What's come to seem to me later, the very essential decisions made was, I think, not even recognized at the time. I didn't see this myself until many years later. Let me say it this way. It would have been possible if the state wanted to try some new and alternate form of school to have asked 50 very smart people to go out and find the best practices you could find anywhere and put them together in a new model and hire some number of the best administrators and come in and start 50 or 100 such schools. This is, I think, essentially what the Edison Project did some years later. Went out and got a math program and a language component and an English component and whatever, packaged them together in a school called the Edison School and wanted to roll out however many of those. Very important that Minnesota legislature did not do that at all. I was not even considered, in my recollection. It was, the decision was to make these this purely enabling legislation. It was open to people to come in and create and try out whatever new form of school organization or new form of learning approach they wanted. Sometimes have to remind ourselves that the legislation did not create a single school, nor did the State Department create a single school. Nobody knew if people were going to come forward to create schools. And one of the truly astonishing things is the response that came in Minnesota and in all kinds of other states around the country. People coming forward with essentially sweat equity put out enormous effort and commitment to design and create and start and run and gradually build up this additional sector of public education. What this means in a way is that chartering represented for the state essentially a research and development program in public education. And a number of the schools, many of the schools that were created, were not innovative in their form of organization or their approach to pedagogy. Some of them were almost more traditional than traditional schools. We went back to uniforms, for example. But some of them were remarkably innovative. Joe had a good deal to do with some of these. And we've had schools that incorporate technology in new and different ways, that move toward project-based learning. We've had some schools in which that are run by partnerships of professional teachers, which I think is a much superior route to teacher involvement than the teacher majority on the board of the nonprofit that is the school. In 2005, the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers came in and did a little amendment to the site management law that, again, I think looked forward partly towards the self-governed school run and managed by teachers. So that concept of chartering as a kind of an R&D program is quite fundamental. I think a lot of folks, many people in Minnesota don't realize the extent to which some of the innovations that have generated in the charter sector here have in fact been copied around the country. I might say just a word about the subsequent legislation. There was a young Minnesotan who was working for the legislature in California in the early 90s who heard about what was going on here and had done a wonderful job of backgrounding legislators in California. Both the Assembly and the Senate were Democratic in those years. And so he had Delaney Easton on the Assembly side and Senator Gary Hart on the Senate side, who got the bill through in California. California really put the idea in business nationally in 93. Six states acted, and it kind of continued to roll on from there with the federal government coming in. It has proved attractive to parents. The fears about creaming proved, certainly in Minnesota, unfounded. It's been very attractive to low-income community and people of color, people whose children are not doing well. It's proved enormously attractive to teachers. The public agenda a couple of years ago in surveying teachers found that 58% of the teachers in their survey nationally, this is Dan Yankelovich's work, would be somewhat or very interested in working in a charter school run by teachers. Two-thirds of the under 5-year teachers and 50% of the over 20-year teachers. When the United Federation of Teachers opened a school it chartered in New York City a few years ago, it had 700 applications for 21 positions. When they opened a high school a couple of years later, they had 1,100 applications for about 23 positions. So this has been a major system change. The last thing I'd say, I guess, is to be careful about the term charter schools. Because there was no model, because the legislature did not do the Edison kind of thing, chartering is open to all kinds of models. A charter school is not a kind of school. And therefore, it is really not possible to talk about in the aggregate. It is not possible, really, I think, to link student scores to the character of a school as either district-owned or private or charter. That makes no more sense to me than to try to relate student scores to whether they're attending a one-story or a two-story building, although you could get data for that. You need to link the student performance to the particular character of the school, to the way it goes about teaching and learning. It seems to me that makes fundamental sense. And then to look at that over time. This is a caution you might need to bear in mind if you listen to people talk about are they successful or not. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Those are the things I wanted to say.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
I do have a question, Madam Chair. I really liked your analogy of calling charter schools sort of the research and R&D of public schools, because I think that I've heard some refer to charter schools as, did they have a role as lab schools, looking at doing some things that maybe would be difficult in a larger school district or larger school. And I think that's happened, but at the time that this was started, was there any discussion of how that feedback would come back? So I think there's been some, you know, some questions of if a school is successful, is there a process or should there be a process in place to bring those that innovation back, or is it we hope you see what is working and do something with it?
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman, I think it's fair to say the state didn't set up any kind of monitoring program.
Mm-hmm.
There was a feeling in some quarters that the school charter should, if they discovered something that worked, go around and tell everybody else about it. They tended to be too busy to do mm-hmm. that. Arguably, it was people should have watched them and begun to take from them. I do think there's a major failure here in American education research, which has not watched this sector closely and has been uninterested in single cases. Lots of times the important innovations start as single cases. A couple of years ago when we were on the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' flight, talked about... it is a true story that the night of the flight, Wilbur and Orville sent a telegram back to the newspaper in Dayton, Ohio, said they'd flown a heavier than aircraft. Nobody had ever done that successfully before and survived. They flew at 120 yards. The editor on the desk that night looked at it and said, 120 yards, one from Paris, put it on the spike, and that was the end of it. At that point, you could still have said truthfully that heavier, the research shows conclusively, overwhelmingly, that heavier than aircraft cannot fly. What difference did all those failures make once Wilbur and Orville had got it right? I think I've said this to people in education research, and I think this is the failure of the research to watch what's going on in this sector and the kind of goofiness with which some of the evaluations are made is part of the reason why its contribution to American education policy is not well understood.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may just make one more acknowledgement in the group of legislators who are key to this, I do not want to miss acknowledging Senator Jen Olson, who was the Republican Senate mm-hmm. counterpart. I know she's still serving today and was hugely, hugely helpful and a great partner in this legislation.
Thank you. Joe Nathan?
Madam Chair, members and ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor to be with you today, and I think it's a great honor to the Minnesota Legislature to be recognized by Harvard as you representing the state of Minnesota, receiving what is widely regarded as the Oscar in public affairs. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of organizations and efforts each year that go to Harvard, and as Amber mentioned a few minutes ago, this idea, the chartering idea, was recognized as one of the very best ideas, and $100,000 came to Minnesota because of your efforts. There are many people in this room with us today, and I want to tell you a little bit about some of those people, a little bit about some of the things that they've created, and respond to the three questions that were asked. How did this happen? How has it evolved? And what's this deal with sponsors anyway? So let's start with some of the people who are in this room with us. You have documents that will document, that will affirm what I'm about to say. Somewhere in this room is Rosa Parks. That Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks took this idea and, building on her enormous courage, stepping on the idea that we ought to expand opportunities, Ms. Parks decided to help create charters in Detroit. And you have the article from the New York Times that describes that. Literally this week, this is the second article in your packet, a group of African American parents and teachers in Topeka as in Topeka Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, are trying to set up a charter public school in the school where Linda Brown was denied access that led to Brown versus Board of Education. And Linda Brown's younger sister is a part of that effort. Paul Wellstone is in this room. In his speech to the Joint Senate and House Committee some years ago, Wellstone hailed you and your colleagues as creating the charter movement that has now spread to 40 states, as legislative staff has mentioned, a movement that started in this building, a movement that started in actuality with one school 10 minutes from this room, serving kids who had not succeeded in traditional school, with less than 100 kids, one school, less than 100 kids, at the City Academy, a school for kids who have not succeeded, who have been pushed out or expelled or kicked out or had not succeeded, started 10 minutes from this room, and now it's spread to more than 4,000 schools this year, serving more than 1.3 million kids. And Wellstone hailed that. Dave Dernberger is in this room. Bill Clinton is in this room. A lot of other folks are in this room. Democrats, Republicans, white people, people of color. And you and your colleagues and your predecessors have inspired, encouraged, and assisted. So what have they created? Well, right over here, maybe show hold up her hand, is the director of Southside Family School. Southside Family School takes kids every year, inner city kids of different races and different economic levels, to the south to see some of the historic places, to see the Pettus Bridge, to see where the bombs went off in Birmingham, to see where Dr. King spoke in Atlanta. That's the Southside Family School, a school that, by the way, voluntarily brings together kids from suburban and urban areas. Right over here is Cindy Moeller. Cindy is the chairperson of Yinghua Academy. Yinghua Academy is one of the first public bilingual Chinese Mandarin schools in the country. It's attracted the attention not only of people from throughout the United States, but the BBC. And Senator, you asked about the replication and the spread. A couple of suburban districts have said, hey, that's a really good idea. We ought to have a Chinese immersion school. And in fact, not only have they replicated this in a couple of suburbs, they've tried to hire some of the Yinghua Academy staff. Asad Zaman was in the room a few minutes ago. Asad's right over here. Asad is, in my opinion, one of the most courageous people I have ever met in my life, and that includes people from the Southern Civil Rights Movement. Asad is the director of one of the schools in this state that has received enormous disrespect, has been the subject of bomb threats because of, I think, incredibly inappropriate and unfortunate misstatements of fact. This is a school where you walk in, Pisa, some of you are familiar with some of the newspaper columns of it. This is the school you walk in 10 different languages. You see in mosaic, welcome. It's a school where people are encouraged. People are assisted, and it's also, by the way, one of the schools that has the highest academic commitment in the state, despite the fact that 75% of the kids are low income and more than 80% of the kids don't speak English in the home. And before you believe anything from a certain columnist in the Star Tribune, I encourage you, as Representative Freiling has done, to go visit that school. Because as an American who's also Jewish, I would be the first to be here pleading with you and with Morgan Brown, a colleague from the Minnesota Department of Education, to close down that school now if the kind of racial hatred and religious intolerance were being presented in that school. But I've spent time in that school, and I would be proud to have a child in that school. Those are only a few examples. A few other examples of what you have helped to create, and then I want to talk a little bit more about the questions that were asked. Bill Clinton came to town toward the end of his legislative session. As Ember said, Bill Clinton joined with Senator Dernberger. Those of you who remember when Bill Clinton and the first President Bush debated And they disagreed on about virtually everything except charter public schools. And I had the opportunity to work with then-Governor Clinton when he was the governor of Arkansas, and he'd asked me to testify about public school choice, another innovation in terms of the state. And Governor Clinton was immediately interested in the charter idea. He saw the genius of giving parents and teachers a chance to create new kinds of public schools, non-sectarian, open to all. And so did George Bush. And they agreed. Just as about a month ago, Senator Obama and Senator McCain disagreed passionately about many things, but this is one thing they agreed on. Both Senator Obama and Senator McCain were deeply committed to expanding charter public schools. Pretty interesting when four different people coming from very different places, three of them elected at one point to be President of the United States, all agreed this is a really good idea. So President Clinton came to City Academy 10 minutes from this room, and Ms. Larson talked about there was a strain of the charter movement which was about helping kids who hadn't succeeded, and I completely agree. And there was a strain about creating new kinds of opportunities for teachers, and I completely agree. It came together with your help. So Milo Cutter, a young woman who was going back about 20 years, had been deeply interested in helping kids who had not succeeded, was delighted when President Clinton, towards the end of his second term, came to Minnesota. And rather than Milo introducing him, a young man named Tom Gonzalez introduced him. And Tom talked, and I won't take your time to tell you the whole thing, but Tom talked about how he had come to Minnesota legally from Mexico, and that he spoke no English when he got here, and he'd gone to a variety of schools and done very badly, and had been kicked out of a couple of schools, and he recognized because of his misbehavior. But he had done very badly, and then he found a young woman that he really liked, and she said that if they were going to have any kind of future, he was going to have to get his rear ends back in school. Except that's not what he said when he was there. But anyway. So he talked about this, and then he talked about how he came to the school, and Milo said to him, "I don't really care what's happened in the past. What do you want to do next?" Tom said, "I'm not sure." And Milo said, "Okay, well, why don't you come back tomorrow? Let's talk about what you want to do next. And when you're ready to talk about what you want to do next, we'd love to have you." So Tom took 2 days, came back, talked about how he felt like if it hadn't been for Milo Cutter and City Academy, he would be dead. He would be dead. But instead, and by the way, Tom had a real tough kind of street jacket on. But as he started to talk about this, he took off his jacket, he had a suit coat on, and explained that after City Academy helped him get an internship, he began to see the value of college, that a local utility had put him through college on a scholarship, and now he was an executive for a local utility. And then he talked about how he understood that one of the best friends of the charter public school movement in the United States was Senator, was President Clinton, and so he introduced him. So he said, "Here's our friend, President Bill Clinton." And you can imagine the impact. Well, that's one of the things that you helped to create. And people from all over the world have come to see that school. We have Tom Ellis over here, a veteran educator who has created an online school. And I could tell stories about each one of these people. I'll just tell you that last year we ran a charter school writing contest on the steps of the state capitol. Several of you were nice enough to come. And that there was a suburban young woman who talked about how Tom's school had saved her life because she was thinking about committing suicide. But the online approach was exactly what she needs. So that's the school that Tom helped to create.
Joe, I hate to interrupt you because I love what you're saying, but we have three more testifiers too,
right.
and I need you to get to your questions.
All right.
I appreciate, I love the stories, but
right.
We're going to need to do them after.
Okay. So, in this document, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. That's great. I appreciate the reminder. So what was the original vision? The original vision was public schools open to all, non-sectarian. Why is it spread so fast? I think it's spread so fast in part because it comes down to three fundamental American ideas. Allowing people to carry out their dreams only if they're willing to be responsible for results, and offering freedom and choice within some limits. These are non-sectarian schools. These are schools open to all with no admission test. In the packet, you can see that there are now 28,000 kids attending charters. The number of kids who are attending charters in the last 10 years is up 23,000, while the number of kids attending district public schools is down 50,000 in the last decade. Charter enrollment is up 23,000. District enrollment is down 50,000. Now, still, the vast majority of charters attend sorry, the vast majority of kids attend district schools, but there is a very clear trend, and you can see who these youngsters are in the chart, which is here in your packet. And you can see that both in Minneapolis and in Minnesota, the number of the charters enroll a much higher percentage of kids who are low income, who are free and reduced lunch, who are limited English speaking. And statewide, about the same percentage of kids who have some form of disability. So, for example, if you look at this chart, Minnesota student demographic information in the bottom left, you can see that last year there were 28,000 plus kids attending charters, and there were 796,000 kids K-12 in district public schools. And you can see the trends. You can see that 53% of the kids statewide who were attending charters are low, free or reduced lunch, compared to 31% of the kids in district schools, and so on right across. There's a comparable chart for Minneapolis. You can see that the charter enrollment in Minneapolis has gone from 1,921 in 01-02 to 7,700 last year, and our analysis of state figures show that more than 9,000 kids in Minneapolis are attending charters this year. We show double-digit increases in both Minneapolis and St. Paul of the number of kids attending charters. The second key question was, how has this evolved? I speak to that a little bit on this how have expectations changed over time on this sheet that says facts. I think we recognize the need for more assistance in developing clear contracts. Eugene Piccolo, who is the director of the State Charter Association, is here, and he's taken the lead. I think he's developing some excellent ideas. We're working together, and he's going to be presenting a little bit later in the fall some ideas about more assistance with creating clear contracts. We need the sponsors to have more training. I think we were a little naive in thinking that sponsors could do this without more assistance. There are a couple of other things that I think that we need to do a better job of, greater training of directors and boards. I encourage you to be very careful about the facilities issues, because I think the state is getting a terrific bargain in its lease aid, but I think there's some things that we could do to facilitate a greater straight value for that. You've heard from district and charter folks alike about the value-added assessment. I would just say two quick things about the history that I'd add to. We have a representative of Minneapolis schools, and going back to the early 1970s, the Minneapolis schools offered a variety of options. And part of this comes out of the civil rights movement, and part of it comes from options that were first offered in the fall of 1971 with the Minneapolis schools, and in the fall of 1971 with St. Paul schools. Finally, in terms of what might be done, efforts to improve charters, you'll see that I suggest several things toward the bottom. You'll see that we've done a poll. But one of the things that I want to mention specifically is that we now have terrific examples of district and charter public schools in this and other states that are clearly improving achievement, that are clearly serving needs of kids in suburbs, rural, and urban areas. And that one of the things that you may very want to do is to take a look at the state money that's currently going to startups and expand it, as the representative of the Minneapolis Public Schools has suggested, expand it so that there are opportunities for both district and charter folks to create replications of outstanding district and charter schools around the United States. And one of the documents that you have available to you is this report that we did that describes outstanding district and charter public schools. In essence, I think you've done a magnificent thing. It absolutely can be refined and improved, but we know quite clearly that there are examples, some of them in this room, of charters that have literally saved kids' lives, and we know examples of schools around the state that have been replicated. Bob DeBoer's school, for example, a New Vision school in North Minneapolis, has received, with assistance from the legislature, the opportunity to work with both district and charter schools in this and other states, and all over this state, people have benefited from the replication of that school. So I think the point you've made about the replication is a really critical point, and I hope you'll return to that. There are some things, and they don't just have to do with money, but there are some things that the legislature could do to encourage the replication of the finest district and charter schools, whether it's learning to teach reading or whether it's working with kids with special needs. There are some things that the legislature could do to promote the replication of outstanding district and charter schools. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Nathan? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I also have some material to leave here. It's a slightly dated 2006, but it's a
he's from the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools that's entitled The Renaissance of Urban Education, Charter Schools in America's Cities, which looked at the impact of charters in five major cities around the country, and the results were very strong. So for urban education, I'll leave these on the table here for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris.
I'd like to have our next three testifiers come to the table. I'm very pleased because they all represent my district, which is the Stillwater and South Washington County School Districts. And Tom Nelson, who is currently the superintendent of South Washington County Schools, is a former state senator and also commissioner of education, and has already been referenced as being involved in this. So I'm very pleased to have him here today. And also Dr. David Wettergren and Dan Parker, who are retired from the Stillwater area schools. But I think as we talk now about charter schools, there seems to be competition between our charter and our traditional public schools. And I think what's really important to note in Stillwater is that they were one of the school districts who came forward in 1993 to sponsor one of our first charter schools, which is New Heights School, and are one of the only continuing sponsors that, you know, continue to sponsor New Heights today, and certainly have been through some ups and downs. But I think what's really important here is that it is a good example of where a public school district has worked with its community to find a school that works for its kids, and also has really continued to develop a very strong relationship with them. So I'm pleased to have all of them here today. Mr. Nelson, maybe you'd like to start.
Madam Chair, committee members, it's a pleasure to be here with you. Ember did a very good job covering the history. I'd like to just touch on a couple parts, because I see charters as part of an evolution that Minnesota has been under for quite some time. And Minnesota has been one of the leaders in this whole movement and should take some great pride in that. My work with this goes back to the 1985 or 6 session when I was still in the legislature and chairing the funding committee in the Senate. That was the session that we had open enrollment and the post-secondary option in the bill. And as Ember said earlier, I can remember the hearing on open enrollment. The room was packed, and we lost on, I think, a fairly close vote, or at least that's what my memory says today. But there was such excitement about stripping open enrollment from the bill that nobody paid any attention to the post-secondary option, and it sailed through a conference committee, and that's how we ended up with the Post-Secondary Option Act. And I have to give Representative Connie Levi a great deal of credit for that. And even Speaker Jennings at the time, who removed my counterpart to chairing the House committee and put Representative Levi in there to finish the bill. And that way she took care of her post-secondary option act. Also, we started work right away. I left the legislature at that time, but coming back with open enrollment, and also during the 86 session, moved the initial parts of the Minnesota School for the Arts, which also was part of the choice options at that time. I have to give Governor Perpich a great deal of credit for that whole early movement in Minnesota. He made it safe for people to get out front on some of those issues. And he spent considerable capital in terms of lobbying legislators and getting people to vote for those bills, even though they weren't very popular at the time. The governor was willing to spend his popularity and his political capital to get those done. The governor many times had to go head to head with teachers' unions who had supported him. Sometimes kicking and clawing in terms of bringing them along to support him, because I think many times they felt that he wasn't supporting them. But my sense was that he was supporting the students and the families in Minnesota at the time. So today, when you look at, as far as I'm concerned, at The choices and options that students have in Minnesota today, including the charter movement, Governor Perpich deserves a great deal of credit. In 1990, I served out his last year. He told me he was going to win re-election, but I served out his last year as the Commissioner of Education, and at that time, he wanted us to get active with the group over here to make sure that we could pass the charter school movement once he was reelected, which didn't happen, but I credit others then for following through with that. So, I think he deserves a great deal of credit. I'd like to comment real quickly on two basic items that were brought up, because I've seen it as a legislator and a commissioner, but now I deal with it as a superintendent of schools. And one of the things that happens in my district, I'm in South Washington County today, Woodbury, Cottage Grove area, and before that I served 10 years in the Buffalo School District. And in both of these districts had some very innovative small schools. Small schools that were able to start because space was available and parents had an interest in a certain type of program and teachers had an interest in a certain type of program. When you're part of a bigger system, there's always a lot of pressure on that movement within that to conform. And as those pressures increase sometimes with budget reductions, I encourage parent groups to meet with charter school advocates and to see if that was a potential possibility for them. One of the difficulties I think that they felt is, that at least the teachers, is that they had all the protections of the school district and really maybe didn't understand the law and didn't want to venture out of the rights and privileges they had of being in a school district. And I think that was both of those programs are operating today, one very healthy and one not so healthy, but again, I think both would have been potentials for chartering. Also the issue, and I think Ember referenced this, that she didn't see it as a competitive model. But I think sometimes when you're in a district, you see it as a competitive model, but not so much in that people are making a choice to go someplace else. The question is why, and why aren't we the choice that they're making? And I think you tend to look at those innovations and see what could you be doing to try and attract those students back to our district. Currently in our school district, we have the Math and Science Academy, which attracts many students. And this current year, they started the Michael Fromm Academy, which is an environmental school. And I think each time one of these gets started, you tend to look and say, what aren't we doing? And then you try and work a little harder, I think, as a public school district to make sure that you're offering choices and options to your own folks. So with that, I'll turn it over.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Madam Chair, committee members, my role this evening, along with my colleague, Mr. Parker, is just a small snapshot of how one of the original charter schools got started, the purpose it served. I was superintendent of schools in the Stillwater School District from 1986 to 1997, so I'm sort of out of there for a period of time now. And I was fortunate to have Mr. Parker as my business manager at the time, and I'm going to have him handle part of this testimony, if that's all right. At the time, Stillwater had about 9,200 pupils in its school district. It had 8 elementary schools at the time, 2 junior high schools. And one of the things that the district had prided itself on as a culture was a sort of open enrollment in its elementary schools. It wasn't without some problems because parents had to transport their own children to the different schools, but the tradition and history of the district was if you were a parent you could choose whatever elementary school you would like to have your child attend. And there was quite a few people moving around the district. We were approached at the time that the charter school program was evolving, as you've heard it this evening, by a former teacher. Actually, he had been a very popular teacher and an assistant football coach in the district, who, along with some parents, was interested in forming a charter school. And he had some credibility with the school board, the district, let me just talk more about myself at the time. I sort of had a philosophy education that was built around the fact that I never did feel as though the traditional public school system could support the needs of all of the students. I think that public school systems throughout our state, the traditional models, do an excellent job, and they're very good school districts, but I had always sensed that we weren't able to serve the needs of all of the kids. And one population that I was worried about at the time happened to be those kids that were sort of falling through the cracks, that by the time they got up into high school were disappearing and were not making it through the regular system. Now, it's important, I think, for you to understand that the notion that came forth from those that wanted the charter wasn't a real creative, far-out, kind of exciting idea, but they had a solid idea. And that idea was that they wanted to serve those kids that weren't making it in our system. And it happened to be a particular interest of mine at the time. It happened to be a particular interest of our school board. And we were able to grant, I think we granted the third charter in the state of Minnesota, and I believe it was the first K-12 charter, New Heights Charter School, and it's still in existence, and they're doing a good, solid job within the community. The type of thing that I think I can bring to it, and Mr. Nathan referred to it just sort of towards the end of his remarks, these charter schools don't start without challenges. Our experience at the time, and as I've looked at the charter school movement over a period of time, quite often the people that come to the table are terribly enthused about an idea. They have a passion for the type of kid that they want to serve within that charter school. But often they lack administrative training. They often lack management training in terms of handling the budget. At that particular time, has already been testified, charter school movement was sort of up in the air. There were a lot of things that had not yet been decided. I can recall even at the time we were chartering, there happened to be one person in the State Department of Education that was sort of the authority on charter school, someone you could call, and that person happened to have been removed from her position right at the time we were chartering our charter school, and suddenly we were looking for people to give us answers, and there really weren't those people there to assist us. Now, fortunately, I had a very excellent assistant superintendent by the name of Mary Jo Weingarten, who was the deputy superintendent, I believe, at the time was her position. And Mary Jo was very instrumental in working with the charter school people in terms of helping them shape with their curriculum. Mr. Parker was the business manager, and I'll ask Dan maybe if you could talk about a couple of the things that you did, and then maybe I can come back with some of the comments.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity. As David spoke, a couple of things came to mind, and also in response to a couple of questions posed before we came. It was a little unique in that the school district owned the building as well. So it was an empty building that was leased then to New Heights, and they still are in this building. One of the challenges, it was talked about already this evening too, was startup dollars. There were no startup dollars at the time. There was no lease aid. So one of the things that the district was involved with, and I wouldn't call it oversight, but certainly some assistance and help in planning, budgeting. Early on, the school, the charter was in statutory operating debt, And they had a plan that was approved that they worked through that we provided some assistance and help with as well. Not monetarily, but just plain oversight. And in the audit report, the involvement or non-involvement of the sponsors was discussed. And I think that was one of the benefits in that the sponsorship, the school district was involved when needed. We talked, it was mentioned about transportation. Stillwater School District is about 28 or 30 miles long and about 8 miles wide. It borders on the river, goes down to Denmark Township in Hastings, and then north to North Marina on St. Croix, 14 communities. As Dr. Wedergren mentioned, there were at that time 8 elementaries. There's one more, two more now, 2 junior highs and a high school, with their individual boundaries, with the high school being district-wide boundary, and the non-public schools, and the charter being district-wide boundary. So this did provide some challenges transportation-wise, but those students that live in the district are transported door-to-door, if you would.
The thing that I would like to sort of focus on and close on in my remarks goes back to one of my very early comments, and that is the charter schools, when they get started, when they get going, I really do firmly believe that they do need some assistance. I think they need training in terms of some of the management aspects of how to run a school. I think that the boards come together, and my sense at that time is that the boards didn't have a lot of support. They didn't have a lot of people they could go to for expertise. And so I think as this next evolution of charter schools evolves and that the movement continues to grow, I think there can be some support systems put in place that and perhaps are being put in place that just weren't there when we got started with the New Heights Charter.
Chairs, I have a question. Number one, I appreciate you guys being superintendents and business agents, because one of my concerns with charter schools is kind of right up that alley. Senator Wieger and I served on the 916 Intermediate School Board together, and when 916 lost the vocational school to the MINSCU system, they were looking at things they could do kind of in an entrepreneurial kind of fashion. And one thing that was talked about when I was still on board there was looking at working with charters to do the financial management of them. Now, I don't know if that came to fruition or not, because I left my local school board by then, but when one of these charter schools is headlined on a newspaper that they bought an Explorer or an Escalade or something like that, it gives a bad name to the whole charter school movement. And so whatever we could do to help the financial management of these schools, I think, would be one of the best things that could be done for charters. And that's where I appreciate a business agent the financial staff from school districts that work with this money all the time. You know, ideas that you guys might have to help charters. Or one last concern is that I hear these companies coming in advertising that we'll come and manage your financial. Well, I was on a school board for 10 years, and, you know, we had a great financial director in the North Branch Schools who's still there, and years of experience. I'm concerned that people that haven't worked with school budgets are offering services to manage these budgets, because I understand how complicated they are. So I'd just like some thoughts for you guys on how financially charter schools might be able to be better managed.
So just a point, Mr. Parker, because you're still involved in supporting charter schools as well, which I think we didn't mention earlier. So you probably have a better perspective on that, and maybe you just want to comment on what you've done in that area.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just one perspective, but since I retired in 2003, I have been involved with a few charter schools, St. Paul Conservatory is one. When they started, and at that point then I, that was my function, so I left. But we did have them set up with a service, but their experience was with smaller schools. That was all they did was schools. And they have, subsequent to that, are handling their own business now. I believe also that the State Department is requiring, and some of you gentlemen can correct me, training of both board members and administration that I don't think was in place early on. And I think that is a significant improvement. I would agree with Dr. Wedegren that this type of in-service, if nothing more, is certainly necessary. I can't answer what 916 is or what they're doing in that regard either. I know they are doing some cooperative efforts on a contract basis, both special ed, legal, and perhaps on the business side. I don't know if I've answered that.
Yeah, I think so. We're a member of 916, and I think if I'm not mistaken, 916 was the sponsor of several charters, and most recently has stopped that. There was a bad relationship with one of the charter schools, and I think it involved financial issues, and I think it soured 916 on the process of being involved. I also think there's a lot of people like Dan. There's a whole cadre today of very, very sharp business managers who are retiring, who I'm certain would offer services to charter schools, and I don't think that should be overlooked, because my guess would most of them fail over the business side of it and probably not the educational side.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want, Superintendent Nelson, you mentioned the Arts High School. Do you think that there would have been an Arts High School had the charter school law passed first? And would then it have been a charter school, or do you think it would have been an Arts High School, regardless?
That would be very hard to say. You know, the Governor Perpich at that time just saw an art school. I don't think he saw a bigger charter school program coming to life in Minnesota. So, I mean, his whole focus was on the arts. My sense is if the charter school had passed sooner, the charter school law probably would have been the vehicle for doing the art school, because the art school was very controversial, and I don't know if it still is, but I think it's a wonderful school today. So,
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's no secret that there are some high-profile cases of financial mismanagement, as Senator Olstein alluded to. I'm wondering, I'd like to hear from the other members of the cast of characters here today, Ted Caldery and Joe Nathan, their thoughts, too, about oversight. I was on the founding board of a charter school. I'm a big fan of the movement. But it's a serious problem, if for no other reason than it's a public relations problem. And even if they are isolated incidents, they do tend to taint the whole enterprise of charter schools. So I'm wondering what combination, and this is a tough question, probably not answerable just today, what combination of state oversight, sponsor oversight, or greater training do you think would help to avoid these kinds of things in the future? Or is it a case that, statistically speaking, it's inevitable that this kind of thing will happen once every while? I don't know what to say other than the headlines are not helpful.
Excuse me. That's the thorny issue that we're going to dive into a little bit later.
Sure.
If you can keep your answer very simple, we are already over time, our time frame, but we will be really looking at this and in particular at our next meeting, so you'll want to be there.
Right. No, I just assume that they're here.
But just, yeah, since they're here, it would be great to hear from them. But we're going to really go into it in depth at our next meeting.
Madam Chair, if I could make just one comment along those lines, I don't want to go past your major topics either. But I've had the real privilege of working with a couple organizations doing sponsor reviews of charters. and I don't claim to be an expert, nor have I done hundreds, but those that we've been involved with, those that are in my opinion, because I was doing the financial side of that, in the best financial condition, were those whose board members were involved, mm-hmm. who knew what was going on, and the sponsors were involved mm-hmm. and knew what was going on. Where that was the case, those charters were in good shape and from all perspectives. That would be the only comment I would make.
I agree with the request to be brief, so I will. Three 30-second points. First, in this document, you'll notice that both the Office of Legislative Auditor and the Minnesota State Department of Education knows that 95% of the charters are not in statutory operating debt. And so I completely agree with Representative Feinman that a small group of schools, and they are misbehaving, are giving the whole movement a pretty bad name. But I think it's important to keep the context in mind. Secondly, people have alluded to an intermediate unit. Well, we actually worked very closely with an intermediate unit and had to essentially demand the State Department not allow that intermediate unit to start a charter because that intermediate unit wanted to start a charter that had less than 40 kids. And we were working with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and has given them a lot of money to start a school, and that intermediate unit wanted to start the school and there weren't enough kids. So I think that the answer is complex. And finally, I think that the State Department of Education has to have the authority to remove some sponsors. Because we have had some sponsors, as the Office of Legislative Auditor notes, that have not done their job. And there is now an agreement that the sponsors need more resources and more staff, but they also need more accountable. And I believe one of the things you're going to hear later this year is that recommendation. And I think it's an excellent recommendation. There's some sponsors, just as there's some schools that are not, just as there's some schools that are not responsible, there's some sponsors that are not responsible. And I think there needs to be explicit authority to the State Department to say, because of this and this and this, you're no longer going to have the authority to do that.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I think part of the answer does run to board training and management training in the school, but I would also urge you to think about the sponsor dimension. Again, the history is important. During the years of discussion that led up to chartering and early after, almost all the attention was on the school. What is the school? What must it be? What must it do? What must it not do? What must it not be? There was almost no attention paid to the sponsor and its role. Minnesota has the widest array of different types of sponsors, but 124D10 enables categories of sponsors, districts, large nonprofits, post-secondary institutions, public, private, and maybe other categories as well. It does sponsoring. We do not have a system in which the state charter sponsors and sponsors then charter schools. We've had these roles, you know, quite mm-hmm. confused. And I've always thought it would make sense for the state to be authorizing sponsors as particular organizations. rather than to simply enabling categories, so that when an organization in that category of any kind of organization can appear in that category, you don't know what you're going to get. But again, this I think you should take up in 09. We think sponsoring can be greatly improved. The sponsor category does need probably to be somewhat reconstituted, and we will bring you some specific recommendations about that for 09.
So we appreciate all these comments, and I think that leads to that we really wanted to focus today on history, and I know that there were a number of statements that went beyond that in terms of advocating or, you know, talking about specific issues, and we really wanted to stay away from some of those controversial things that have come up, but we do want to talk about them in a very thoughtful way. And I know that I have sent an email out to all the senators on this committee asking for their particular issues, concerns, and we're also trying to determine our next date for our next meeting, because I think it's an important meeting having the legislative auditor report. And I think that's when, again, it'll be a good time for us to listen to some of the issues, and that instead of defending either traditional schools or elsewhere charter schools, is really thoughtfully listening to some of the issues so that all of our schools are stronger. And I think that today we really focus on charter schools and all the good things that they do, but I also believe that all of our public schools do, you know, tremendous work with our young people. We always can do better, but I think that we need to acknowledge that our, you know, traditional public schools, that there are representatives here today from those schools, and they should acknowledge the important work that they do as well.
And I would also like to say that Becky, Representative Becky Calzo's testimony will be emailed to everyone in the committee. And I think we've had some great testimony today and some very interesting information. And again, the purpose was to get some background, to get some idea about where this all came from. And so we can move forward with the perspective of this is why we have these schools. And keep that perspective in mind as we look at the controversial issues that are coming before us. We will get to you with the next meeting date. There is some controversy there. At any rate, do I get to hit this again?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.